Welcome to Understanding Congress, a podcast about the first branch of government. Congress is a notoriously complex institution, and few Americans think well of it. But Congress is essential to our republic. It's a place where our pluralistic society is supposed to work out its differences and come to agreement about what our laws should be. And that is why we are here, to discuss our national legislature and to think about ways to upgrade it so it can better serve our nation. I'm your host, Kevin Kosar, and I'm a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, a think tank in Washington, D.C. The topic of this episode is, what is Congress's role in a contingent presidential election? Two centuries ago, America had a contingent presidential election. No candidate got a majority of votes, and thus it fell to Congress to decide who got to be president. Might the United States have another contingent election? Certainly it's possible. Four of the past six presidential elections have been very close. In 2020, had 44,000 voters in Georgia, Arizona, and Wisconsin picked Trump instead of Biden, we would have had a tied election with each candidate receiving 269 electoral votes. And then it would have been up to Congress to decide. So what exactly is Congress's role in contingent elections? How does that work? To answer these questions, I have with me my colleague, Dr. John Fortier. He's a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, where he studies Congress and elections, election administration, election demographics, voting, and much more. John's the co-author of the books After the People Vote, A Guide to the Electoral College, and Absentee and Early Voting, Trends, Promises, and Perils. John also hosts the Voting Booth podcast. John, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Kevin. Pleasure to be here.
So let's start with a simple question. Why must a presidential candidate get 270 electoral votes in order to become the president?
Well, there's a short answer and a long answer. The short answer is that 270 is a majority of the electors that are possible to be cast. The longer answer is that there was a debate in the Constitutional Convention about how to elect the president, but it came sort of late in the process. And I would say the first thing that they needed to decide is, what did Congress look like? And there were all sorts of debates and back and forth before a compromise was reached where essentially the House of Representatives was one that represented the people more broadly. The states would have number of House representatives based on their population, and the Senate would be equal in the states. Now, when coming to the Electoral College, figuring out how to elect the president, two big principles. One, they had decided at this point that they wanted the president to be elected separately from the Congress, not like a parliamentary system, not something coming out of the Congress. And secondly, that they were going to reflect that compromise in Congress. And so the real number of 270 or the larger number of electors that are available are basically all of the states have two electors for the senators that they have, and then they have a certain number of electors in the House of Representatives based on their House delegation and also D.C. votes. So that's what gets you the total, but it is something of a compromise coming out of a compromise, and this is a majority of the votes that you need.
So it's a constitutional thing. It's not a statutory thing. All right, next. For the sake of listeners, let's imagine a scenario to kind of illustrate a contingent election and then ultimately how Congress is involved. Let's pretend it's mid-November of 2024 and we have Mr. Biden, Mr. Trump tied at 269 electoral votes each. Or maybe they each got fewer than 270 thanks to a third-party candidate garnering a handful of electoral votes. We Americans cast our votes. We see this lack of 270. What happens next? It's the middle of November. What's the process for going forward? And please feel free to take your time to lay it all out, because I know there's a lot of steps, but the audience would benefit from hearing it.
Well, you're right to point to two scenarios. One would be that there's a tie in the Electoral College, and today's numbers, that would be 269 to 269. Therefore, no one has a majority. Or perhaps there's a third-party candidate who takes enough electors so that neither of the candidates gets to 270. So those are the types of situations which down the road, we'll walk through the process, are going to get you to a contingent election, one that doesn't go the regular way of counting the electors. Now, in the meantime, there are steps, and these steps usually go according to form, but of course there are potential for some difficulties in each of them. The first, of course, is the casting of the votes by the electors themselves. We the people vote in November, but we are ultimately electing these electors. They are going to their state capitals in each of the 50 states and the District of Columbia, and they are casting ballots in mid-December. And those ballots are ultimately then sent on to Congress and are then going to be counted on the date that many people, of course, know now, January 6th, date which was often kind of obscure for people because it is typically a very simple process where votes are counted and ultimately, in almost every case other than two in our history, that someone is at a majority of the electoral votes. At which point, if that's the case on January 6th, we have a official president-elect. That person is going to take office on January 20th. We similarly do the same thing with the vice presidential votes from the electors for the vice president, elect a vice president. But if we're talking about a situation that you laid out where one way or the other, that counting of the votes on January 6th does not get to 270 for one person, then we go into what is sometimes labeled a contingent election. And if all is clear, the House of Representatives will immediately convene once we've counted all those votes and nobody has a majority, and they will convene to vote for a president, but they'll do so in an untraditional way. They'll essentially be voting by state delegation. So the House of Representatives, which in usual case, it represents the states in population, lots big states have lots of votes, small states have few votes, each state has essentially one vote. And then each state delegation, which could be made up of a bunch of people, are somehow going to have to, cast that ballot. The other interesting thing to note, I think that's important, is you do need to get a majority of states, not just a plurality. You need 26 of the 50 states in the contingent election, state delegations, to elect a president. And there are a number of ways in which you might not get that. I mean, obviously, if there are three candidates, maybe that's one possibility. But another way, of course, is that we might have some delegations that are split, a delegation that has one Republican and one Democratic rep. And that wouldn't count to the total, assuming both those people voted according to party. And you might have a case where there are 25, somebody has 25 delegations, somebody has 23, and there are two delegations that are split, and that's not enough to elect the president. So there's a potential for a deadlock here, and you don't necessarily easily get to the 26. Just one more thing lurking in the background, of course, is if for some reason that election is deadlocked or doesn't get to a conclusion, at least right away, there is also, of course, the vice president might be facing the same issue. You might have the vice president not have a majority of the electoral votes. In that case, the Senate convenes. The Senate votes like it typically does, but you need to get a majority of the senators and then ultimately elect a vice president. And perhaps that might not happen either, but more likely that's not going to divide in the same way. But you could either have a vice president who's elected, no president, and kind of get to January 20th and have that vice president take over. Possibly you could have both of the contingent elections held up, in which case we'd go all the way to January 20th, and then we'd have to go to the line of succession, meaning the Speaker of the House in today's line. So it's a complicated process, but there is a role for Congress, the House voting very differently than it typically does, and the Senate voting for the vice presidential candidate if there's no majority for either of these in the case of electing the vice president.
Wow, there's a lot going on there. So just as a follow-up, so we have the House having to vote for the president, the Senate having to vote for the vice president, and in the House, let's just go back to basically a purple state example. You imagine a state that has 10 representatives, and let's say six of them would prefer Mr. Trump, four of them would prefer Mr. Biden. Does their state then get counted towards the presidential total? Is that, there's nothing in the Constitution about that, is there? Or do they have to be unanimous? Do we know?
Yes, so it is in the Constitution that you're going to need a majority of the states, not just a majority of those who cast ballots for one or the other. So In our current 50-state arrangement, you're going to need 26 states in the House of Representatives. There is some lack of clarity, or the House has had some precedents and could go the other way, perhaps changing this, in the question of, do you need a majority of the state delegation? Now, this would be likely only the case where there are three parties or three presidential candidates who are being considered. And just one thing to note, with the 12th Amendment, the House can only consider the top three candidates. They can't consider anybody else. And that was important, actually, in 1824, when there was a fourth major political candidate couldn't be considered. But it's not absolutely clear. So if there were a state that had nine reps and it was 4-3-2, the House has at times believed that maybe the four would prevail. But we're not absolutely sure about that. So the House might have a role. I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, and sorting that sort of thing out. Well, you've already indicated that we could end up in a peculiar situation where if the House can't come to agreement, the Senate could, in theory, come to an agreement about who gets to be the vice president, and then would that vice president succeed? Become the president come January 20th?
Yes, a couple things. One, maybe just to step back a little bit, the thinking about what might realistically happen. We could go back to the 1800 election. That was one of the two elections, 1800 and 1824, where we did have this contingent election. And in 1800, the Electoral College looked a little different. We hadn't passed the 12th Amendment. And it was a bit of a quirk that it was a tie between two people, which you'd say were of the same party, Thomas Jefferson and Aaron Burr. They were running like a ticket. And the Federalists didn't do as well, but they controlled a number of congressional delegations. And this tie really could only be resolved with some of the help of the Federalists, who controlled some of the congressional delegations. So my point is, without getting into all of that, there was some bargaining, right? There was the possibility, and ultimately, especially with the urging of Alexander Hamilton, who preferred Jefferson to Burr, the Federalists did, some of them come along, or some of them abstained, and some of them came along in a way that allowed that election to go for Jefferson, and then in that case, the second place person, Burr, became the vice president. So I think there is bargaining that's likely to happen. If there is a deadlock and you don't actually elect the president, I think most constitutional scholars believe that the president is still sitting there kind of in waiting, right? The vice president is going to become the president, but ultimately, if the presidential election were later decided, if the House came up later in the Congress and decided that president could sort of later come back into play.
Okay. Well, thinking about this process a bit more, earlier you referenced January 6th as the date where a new Congress convenes, and one of the things they do on that date, if it's a presidential election year or just after the November election, then they're going to sit and do the electoral votes, count the votes. But to do that, they first have to pick a speaker, right? Because when they begin, the chamber opens up, there's actually a clerk who's kind of presiding over it. And I guess the Constitution says, the House shall choose a speaker. So you have to choose a speaker to swear in the new members so that you can get this body up and running to conduct business, right? Which you can see where this leads. If the House is incapable of choosing a speaker, if we have another Kevin McCarthy sort of situation, thanks to the very narrow margins, does the counting of the electoral votes get delayed?
I think the answer first is that, of course, this doesn't happen very often. We did see it. I think many people, while we wouldn't like to see this, could think of a way of which the House might not proceed with the speaker. I mean, we did essentially do that in the sense of we had the interim speaker, Patrick McHenry, and there are some rules, some of them came into being related to sort of continuity of government issues about sort of successor speakers and a list of people who might just step in if there is no speaker, and McHenry was on that list. There are people, I think, who will argue that maybe the House itself, and it's tricky because one has to get to a certain point of swearing in the members, but by some agreement of the people who are putatively elected, that there would be maybe an agreement to swear people in, proceed without a speaker. I don't think anybody would prefer that, but I don't think that by itself it would absolutely prevent the House from going forward. If you mean that there's a determined majority in the House to stop the counting on January 6th and not to go to that joint session, It is in the Constitution. We're going to have the joint session, but I don't think there's anything that really stops. No court or others would stop and say the House must join this joint session. Similarly, the Senate, it's the right thing to do. It's what they're supposed to do constitutionally. But if you really had a determined number of people, a majority of people, I think you could do a lot of things to muck up the process. So I don't think that's going to happen, and I don't recommend it. But, you know, at the end of the day, determined majorities in Congress can do a lot.
That's true. Determined majorities can do an awful lot, especially in the House, which is a majoritarian entity, but certainly also true in the Senate. The earlier you referenced January 20th and a line of succession, for the help of listeners who are not familiar with it, could you talk a little bit about what this is? Is this a constitutional thing? Is it a statutory thing? And who's in this line?
Yes, it is both a constitutional and a statutory thing. So the original Constitution, but then sort of laid out in some later pieces in the 12th and 20th Amendments, have a process by which, you know, the vice president is going to take over for the president if the president dies, resigns, you know, is impeached and removed, incapacitated. That's a little trickier, but also clarified by the 25th Amendment. But there are ways in which the president might not be able to be president and the vice president steps in. That's clear. What then it says is that Congress may provide a line of statutory line of succession. It says some more specific things like she'll say which officer shall be next to be in line. And over the years, we've had three big different ideas, different laws of presidential succession. The first one had just the president pro tem of the Senate and the speaker. So it was the two of them. And the second one, starting in the 1880s, had a cabinet succession, just the members of the president's cabinet, no members of Congress. And then the current line of succession we've had since, you know, Harry Truman put it in place in the late 1940s, where there is a mix. Today, the Speaker of the House, the president pro tem, those are the top two people. And then there's all the cabinet members in the order that the cabinet's departments were created. So it's both. And I don't want to get too much in the weeds. I will say there has been some constitutional debate over the years of whether it is appropriate or not to have members of Congress in the line of succession. That's something actually James Madison early on said, you cannot have that. Even though we did that in the first law, James Madison protested and said, no, officer here means somebody in the executive branch. And without going into all the details, we at AEI and with Brookings at times have had a continuity of government commission. And part of the recommendations of that commission has been to, I think both constitutionally and also practically, there might be more sense in having members of the cabinet be in the line of succession, because there are a lot of difficulties of thinking about bringing a speaker over and being the president, either temporarily, for a long time, change of party, the separation of powers issues. So our current line has the Speaker of the House as the next person in the statutory line of succession after the vice president. And if for some reason there was no president elected, no vice president elected, and we got to January 20th, that speaker would be the one who would step in and become president.
Right, yeah, and I could see the concerns about having a legislator step into the chief executive role. You mentioned the speaker and the Senate pro tempore, the longest serving senator, correct?
By custom, of course, we didn't always pick it that way, but yes, today that's one of the criticisms of the line, that it's often a very senior elderly senator from the majority party, not necessarily not the majority leader, but they could be the same person, but typically that's not the case.
Yes, and there is, of course, the old salty observation that each morning a senator gets up and looks in the mirror and says, "Hello, Mr. President." So in terms of incentives for people who would like to briefly ascend the nation's highest office, perhaps having that pathway is not ideal.
That's true, although I will note, you know, one other thing that's something of a conflict of interest in the case of, let's say, impeachment. Let's say you were to try to remove the president and the vice president, or one of them weren't there. There's a bit of a, you know, self-interested matter that perhaps the party in the House that's in the majority might put its own person in place. In fact, there was some rumblings. It was not done by the majority, but back in the days when Vice President Agnew had resigned and there was President Nixon who some saw as on the ropes, and there were some people saying, well, don't confirm Gerald Ford, because now we can appoint a new vice president with the 25th Amendment. And if you didn't appoint Vice President Ford and then impeached Nixon, the president would have been Carl Albert, the Speaker of the House. And there were even some efforts with some Democrats, if actually the Democratic Party, getting significant memos written about what would the Carl Albert presidency look like.
We can never forget about incentives, can we? And we can never forget Madison's point that you can't expect people in politics to be angels. Well, John, this has been illuminating. I think we all have come away from it a lot more understanding of how the process work. As a closing question, since amongst your many areas of scholarship are a scholar of continuity of government, when you look at the current process for Congress having to deal with a contingent election, do you think it's a pretty strong, robust, steady process and that we can relax and not be anxious about it? Or is this something that maybe some sort of reforms really should be put in place to just ensure that things go smoothly?
Well, I will say, and I hadn't actually thought of it before, is we are coming up on the 200th anniversary of the last time we've had a presidential contingent election in the House. It was 1824, we had the last one. So it's a good thing we haven't had a lot of them. I think with our two-party system, which is pretty strong, I think we're less likely to have it. Really, the case of multiple candidates is not that likely. So really, it almost has to be this 269-269 tie. You know, that being said, the Electoral College itself is not popular in most public opinion polls. There are people who don't like the idea of the popular vote being able to go one way and the Electoral College go vote the other way. I think if they then got to a further step where this is a very obscure procedure and one that in the House of Representatives, all of a sudden it turns the House of Representatives back into something like the Senate. The House is voting by states, which is much more unequal than the Electoral College itself. Unfamiliar, again, could elect a president who didn't win the popular vote. I'm not sure the American people are going to love seeing this process. And there are some little things around the edges that Congress can do to clarify the rules about how it works. But if you were to really want to get rid of it, basically requires a constitutional amendment. There is an effort out there, a complicated effort, which I won't get into, which has a system where maybe a bunch of states band together and agree to cast their electors for the winner of the popular vote, sort of indirectly bypassing the Electoral College. That still is hard to do. You have to get a bunch of states to do it, and they're not at a majority yet, but primarily the way this provision is in the Constitution, and so it's very difficult to reform. So I think some clarity of what we do about it. I think one point, we won't get into it here, but one point to clarify sometimes where is it a question of did Congress not get a majority of people or did it just deadlock? Because that's a different situation. Deadlock probably means going to January 20th and the Presidential Succession Act, and the not having a majority, meaning all the votes are counted but not having a majority, goes to this contingent election. So clarifying when you go to what, how it works, I think it would be a good thing, but I'm not sure the American people are going to really love seeing this in action if we do end up having it.
All righty. John Fortier, thank you for helping us better understand the role of Congress in a contingent presidential election.
Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you for listening to Understanding Congress, a podcast of the American Enterprise Institute. This program was produced by Jaehun Lee and hosted by Kevin Kosar. You can subscribe to Understanding Congress via Stitcher, iTunes, Google Podcasts, and TuneIn. We hope you'll share this podcast with others and tell us what you think about it by posting your thoughts and questions on Twitter and tagging @AEI. Once again, thank you for listening and have a great day.